Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Jack Spencer, and Jacob Kanzler. A little later, we're going to be speaking with two of the three Democratic Attorney General candidates, Patrick Miles and Dana Nessel. We're going to ask them a few questions in the run-up to the Democratic Convention. Also, Ed Zarpolis will be joining us for a few minutes to also give his thoughts going into the Democratic Endorsement Convention this weekend. And Jack, this could end up being a very, I don't know if polarizing is the word, but a unique convention in the sense that Dana Nessel has promised to bring a lot of the progressive types in the Democratic Party, the Bernie-crats, if you will. And now we're seeing the UAW and now today the AFL-CIO endorsing Pat Miles. We could have a showdown of two different, entirely different wings of the Democratic Party.
Yes, and what makes it really interesting is the whole way the Democratic side is set up with this picking their slots ahead of time before the primaries, et cetera, that the Democrats do. And I'm not so sure that Democrats, especially if any of these are close races for these spots, I'm not so sure that the Democrats don't run a risk of turning a lot of people off if they try to plug these candidates in too soon.
I think the hope is, John, is that by settling the Patrick Miles, Dana Nessel race for Attorney General here in April, it will give the party 3 months or 6 months, really, in this case, until November, to feel good about themselves, to coalesce, to become one, become unified. There's a risk that doesn't happen.
Well, yeah, and I think this is, what, the third cycle we've done this early sort of Democratic nomination convention. And clearly, that was the plan. That was the intent. Let's clear away the battle and give our guys enough time to actually campaign to be better situated for the general election. The problem is, though, I mean, you think about if you think about what happened with the 2016 election with the Democrats, and specifically, you can really see in a point in time where this early nominating convention. Progressives could argue, the Bernie-crats could argue, this is one more sign of a rigged system. This is one more case where this was set up by organized labor to sort of predetermine the outcome before any of us really have a chance to weigh in and to decide for ourselves. You could really see that kind of argument being made, certainly if it's a close race in this case, if it's really close on the floor, I could see a lot of people walking away thinking this is just a rigged deal.
On the other side of it, Jack, you could say if the Bernie-crats do show up in mass and they do push Dana Nessel into the endorsement category, the story coming out of this will be, oh my goodness, what has happened to the AFL-CIO? What has happened to the UAW? They've lost all this clout.
Well, yes, that's true, and they won't like that, obviously. But I do think the Democrats have a bigger problem with this than what has generally been reported. I think what happened in 2016 with the Bernie Sanders thing, simply finally was an example of something that had been taking place even in elections before that. I think there are just as many people on the Democratic side who don't like the feeling that everything's rigged, that the system's all being handled by the puppet master, so to speak. And I think that was there, and I think it showed up in the fact that these people didn't vote in many of the previous elections, that they were just turned off by the system. Not as much. One problem we have sometimes is I think we get too caught up in the ideology. And we sometimes forget maybe people have a similar ideology, but they just don't like the system or they feel like things are rigged. And
we had this on the Republican side.
We had on the Republican side with the Tea Party, and some of those are sometimes suppressed. But I would argue that the way the narrative on the right works is to represent those Tea Party people more so, to more or less call almost every Republican that runs, we can't trust these people at all. They say they're anti-government, but then they get there and then they spend money like crazy, et cetera, et cetera. But they actually, it's a little bit of a different shtick the way it's done on the right. They are more the voice of the Tea Party side, of the anti-establishment side. And so when it gets to election time, they're kind of told, yeah, these people are awful, they're bums, but you know what? They're still better than these right. horrible people that are running against them, so I guess you got to vote for a bum this time.
There are bums.
But the Democrats are different because they don't show up.
Well, the Democrats don't do it. I don't see the narrative coming from the top down on the Democratic side that is anti-establishment nearly as much. It's part of the narrative. Do you hear them ever talking about, you know, these people are hypocrites? These people in the Senate are come out screaming against big corporations, but they're taking millions of dollars right from it. You don't have the same dynamic. And I think the lack of expression and the lack of a voice on the left has resulted in a lot of potential Democratic voters sitting out elections.
Right.
Well, they've been disillusioned, and for good reason. When you sort of look at what happened in 2016, I mean, thanks in part to the Russian hackers, we saw exactly what the Democratic National Committee was doing to help Hillary Clinton vis-a-vis Bernie Sanders. And if you were a Bernie Sanders supporter, I'm sure you became very disillusioned in democracy with the big D, you know?
And this convention could be an example or could be an opportunity for these folks you're talking about to take over their party, to take back their party, as opposed to letting these insiders run things.
Yeah, true? I think it's an opportunity, and I think there's a lot of danger involved because, let's face it, the people who like to run things, the people who are used to being the power behind the throne, so to speak, et cetera, they don't want to give that up very easily. They never do. They never do on either side.
But let's take a look at this from the UAW-AFL, the organized labor standpoint. The last time we had a contested convention of any note was the Lon Johnson-Mark Brewer race. And in that case, the UAW actually had a reason to get people out, because getting Mark Brewer out in the first place was their idea. They wanted Lon Johnson. He was their guy. He'd always been their guy. And they had to have this big show of strength to let everyone know that when we have our mind set to something, by God, it's going to happen. And it happened in a real big way. They didn't even bother to vote. Now, if you go back to 2010, the last time they had this endorsement convention, they got behind David Layton against Richard Bernstein for Attorney General. And that one went down to the final precinct time, John Dingell's seat. And so they almost lost. So I bring this up to say, are they invested in Pat Miles the way they were invested in Lon Johnson? And I would say no, it is not their guy. They got involved, they decided to endorse, but it's not like they recruited Pat Miles and he was their cat all along. So this race, I think, is going to be a little bit more up in the air than folks might think. This could be a real close election, and I don't think it's out of the bounds of reality here to think that Dana Nessel could win this thing. Jacob, I want to get your thoughts on what you're seeing, what you're hearing, what you're feeling about this endorsement convention.
Yeah, I think you make a good point, Kyle, about how invested is the UAW, and if you believe they're not as invested in Pat Miles as they were in, you know, Lon Johnson, I think that will be a big determining factor. I mean, it depends on who shows up on Saturday, right? Yeah. I mean, it showed, like, we had a story about how both candidates are claiming they have registered, you know, hundreds, thousands of Democrats for this. Are there folks going to show up? Is Dana Nessel going to get these progressives out? Is the UAW-AFL-CIO, are their numbers going to show up and make a difference for Pat Miles? Is this kind of growing narrative of this these two butting heads in the last week, is that going to fire people up this week to go? So, I mean, it kind of all depends on who shows up and if anything else kind of happens this week that kind of fans the flames on both sides, if this is really how things are dividing up.
If you're Brandon Dillon, the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, your worst nightmare, Jack, is?
I think the worst nightmare would be that, once again, an awful lot of Democrats somehow end up feeling like they were left out of the process, feeling like the process was controlled from the top, in which case you're creating a scenario again, which has happened, I believe, in the elections going back to 2010, where a lot of potential Democratic voters simply don't feel like they want to get off the couch and vote on election day. That's the worst case scenario for the Dems.
Worst case scenario is an AG candidate is endorsed, but the person who was not endorsed does not concede or drop out. I mean, if you see, the whole point of this is to kind of coalesce around someone ahead of time, and that doesn't happen. I mean, this is going to be a distraction. This is going to be kind of not moving forward quick enough like the Democrats want ahead of the nomination convention in August.
What do you think is the worst nightmare, John?
If you're Brandon Dillon, it comes right down to the very end. You got a handful of votes, and there's some procedural maneuver, perhaps, that the unions employ to hand it to Miles, and you have hundreds or thousands of people walking away from that thing, not only feeling but convinced that the whole system was rigged.
And do they want to participate in the process going forward?
Do we even want to vote?
One more thing that we should mention here. There is a third candidate, William Noakes, who is running. Over the weekend, however, the 13th Congressional District Democrats endorsed Pat Miles and not William Noakes. So I know that he was counting on that Detroit vote to help him be relevant in this process. But without the 13th Congressional District, I don't know how possible that is at all. So we'll mention his name. He's going to be there. But presuming he doesn't drop out ahead of time, don't really see him being a factor at this point. So, all right, with that, let's get into some interviews. Joining us now on the podcast is the Attorney General candidate on the Democratic side, Pat Miles. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, first thing I wanted to ask you about, obviously the endorsement convention is not anything that is statutorily required for the state of Michigan. The formal nomination takes place in August. So with that in mind, do you see that this endorsement convention is binding on the August primary convention?
Well, we've all signed a pledge, all the candidates for Attorney General have signed a pledge that if we do not receive the endorsement, we will discontinue our campaign. So it really does lead to the eventual nomination of whoever wins this this endorsement.
Okay, so if you're not successful, then you will support the person who is endorsed as a result of this convention?
That's right, absolutely. Okay.
Even if you lose by 5 votes, 10 votes, it doesn't matter?
Well, it doesn't matter because that's the will of the convention. If that's the vote that's decided, then yes, that's going to be the decision.
I wanted to also ask you about a couple issues that have kind of popped up recently. One of them is this legislative package that is hot in the legislature right now, dealing with sexual assault. I don't know if you've taken a look at this, but one of the provisions of this is extending the statute of limitations on sexual assault cases up to 30 years and instituting a retroactivity that allows assailants who've been assaulted back to 1997 to go after their assailants. Is that anything you've taken a look at, and is that something that you could support?
I could definitely support it. I think it's very important and because sexual assault and harassment, they aren't a punchline. They're very serious things, and it's not just about talking the talk. It's about walking the walk. As U.S. attorney, I prosecuted several sex trafficking cases, 7 sex trafficking cases and of child sex trafficking, and 106 child exploitation cases. And I got Larry Nassar off the street and behind bars on child porn charges. This is a very serious thing, and I think this legislation is a very helpful tool to address it.
I also wanted to ask you about the Flint water crisis. Do you think the current attorney general has politicized his handling of the Flint water crisis?
I think the Attorney General has politicized everything in his office. He has politicized the Flint water crisis. He's politicized health care. He's politicized so many things that are important to the people of Michigan. And unfortunately, he's politicized the Michigan State investigation as well. I called for an outside investigator and an independent investigation, but not necessarily one that needed to be outside of the Attorney General's office. And so I think with Flint, I think there was definitely a crime committed there. Need to look at all the facts and evidence to see who is ultimately responsible, and we need to see what comes out of that facts and evidence in all these cases. And I think Bill Schuette has made some very bad decisions with Flint and his handling of this investigation and prosecution that caused a lot of people to have doubts that I hear time and time again on the campaign trail. People have a lot of doubts that the right people are being prosecuted and that the prosecutions are not political.
If the legislature passes a law that you don't personally agree with, would you defend it in court
for the state of Michigan, or would you find someone else to defend the state?
Well, that really depends on circumstances at the time and the type of law that it is. That's a hard question to ask in hypothetical fashion, because there are laws that you're morally and duty-bound by virtue of your oath of office to defend as the chief law enforcement officer for Michigan. But there are also laws that you can have a discretion of whether or not you're going to defend them in the court. And some of those, I think, really will depend on the circumstances of the law at the time.
Well, I saw in my press releases today that you received the endorsement of the UAW, AFL-CIO, the 13th Congressional District. So congratulations on those. You got to be very happy where you are right now in your campaign.
We are. We're very happy. We're building a lot of great momentum going into the convention on April 15th. We've gotten a lot of great labor support, as you mentioned, the AFL-CIO, the UAW, the IBEW, the UFCW, both their locals. Getting tremendous support from the African-American community, too. I've got the Fannie Lou Hamer PAC endorsement. So we're really loving the support that we're getting and the momentum that we're building going into the convention.
Obviously, there has been some criticisms that the law firm that you were with was defending businesses that were engaged in anti-union activity. Your response on that has been fairly consistent. Just to remind our listeners what that's been.
Well, I don't do that type of work. I don't do that type of legal work. I never have, and I wouldn't. I come from a union background, a union family, and I'm a strong believer in unions, and that's shown by the union support that I'm getting from the labor unions in this campaign. And the reality is that large law firms have a lot of different practice areas, and that's the practice area that law firm that I work for has. But it's not who I am. It's not the work that I do.
All right. Anything else you want to say here before we let you go?
Well, the work that I do relates more to minority and small businesses, and I also worked with municipalities representing them, adverse to cable companies fighting for consumers, fighting for getting lower cable rates and better customer service. So that's been my practice area. And before we go, just wanted to say that, yes, we're in good position to win this convention and looking forward to taking on the Republican in the fall, because I think they're going to have a tough record to run on. The Bill Schuette record is not a good one as Attorney General. It's something where he's been very political. He's been taking stances such as he went out of his way to fight labor unions in a case before the United States Supreme Court, and to author a brief there that would basically make right to work the law of the land and put Michigan's law of right to work on steroids. And so these are things that are very important to the people of Michigan, and I'm ready to fight for the people of Michigan. We're ready to fight for the working people of Michigan, fight for the environment, fight for consumers, fight for the vulnerable. That's who I am, and that's what I am, and that's what I'm going to do as Attorney General.
Very good. Pat Miles, Attorney General candidate for the Democratic ticket. It looks like this is a race that's going to be finalized 6 days from now. Appreciate you taking some time and talking with us for the podcast.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Kyle.
All right, joining us now for the podcast is Democratic Attorney General candidate Dana Nessel. Thanks for being on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so first question I want to ask right out of the box. Do you see this endorsement convention this weekend as being a binding vote in that that whoever is picked on Sunday will be the nominee in August?
Well, it's a binding vote for me. I have pledged all along that as long as everyone who has registered with the party before the 30-day cutoff has an opportunity to vote, and the voting is done in a manner that's fair and the results are fair, absolutely, I will abide by the vote no matter what the outcome is.
And now, you mentioned if the vote is fair. What do you mean by that? Is there possible that, are you concerned that it may not be fair? Or
I'm not really concerned. I am very hopeful everything will be done correctly. They have a new system in place. I think they hired a third party to coordinate it. But everything's going to be done on tablet, so there's going to be no paper receipts of everybody's vote. So, I mean, do I have some concerns? I mean, I think that I would be naive or foolish not to have a few concerns. But I trust that the party's trying its very hardest to make certain that the outcome is one that truly reflects how people voted.
Okay. All right, well, let's hit some of the issues here that are hot right now. One of them has to do with this legislative package that has passed the state Senate regarding extending the statute of limitations on sexual assault cases to 30 years and retroactively stretching cases that of sexual assault that happened back to 1997. Have you had a chance to look at that, and is that something that you might be able to support?
You know, I haven't actually read the bill. I have heard a bit about it. I'm going to tell you that I do have some concerns about it. On one hand, I understand wanting to make certain that people can be held accountable no matter how long it is after an offense, particularly one that has to do with criminal sexual conduct, occurs. But on the other hand, as somebody who has both prosecuted many, many of those cases, but also defended them, you know, it's hard to defend yourself when you are accused of something that happened decades ago, and when somebody makes that allegation or that accusation against you, and you have no way, there's no way feasible for a person to say where they were, you know, 25 years ago. And so obviously I am firmly in favor of making certain that there is an adequate period of time after a person reaches adulthood if there was a crime committed against them when they were a child. 100% that should be the case. We should not expect children to have to make complaints against their abusers, particularly since they're usually people that are known to them. And I should tell you, I've spent many, many years in the child abuse unit in the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, so I have a lot of familiarity with these. But on the other hand, I do have concerns about people making allegations, especially when people have been adults for many, many years and have a long time to be able to make that report but fail to do so. And then you have a person who has to defend themselves against something that happened decades and decades ago, and that's very, very hard to do. So I would want to read the bill. I'd want to, you know, hear as much from both sides on that issue before making an assessment. I wouldn't be able to vote one way or the other because, of course, I'm not running for a legislative position. But I do think people need to understand that there are two sides to that issue. And, by the way, I have defended people who there were allegations that were filed against them. There were complaints that were filed. And after doing a tremendous amount of investigation, it turned out we could corroborate that the accused was in another state or didn't even, you know, live anywhere, didn't even know the person at that time. So I've actually been able to do that. But, you know, as much as we don't like to think that false accusations ever happen, they sometimes do, and we have to also protect the rights of criminal defendants. So I look at it on both sides. I see a reason for both things. And I'd want to look at it further before making a decision as to whether I support it or not.
Now, you mentioned your law firm. Now, I understand that you guys have taken these kind of cases where you've defended people who have been accused of sexual assault. Does that go against the kind of Me Too movement? Is that sending a signal that you're not in support of people who claim to have been sexually assaulted?
I think it sends a message that I believe in upholding the Constitution. Which is what I do. And like I said, I have more prosecutorial experience than if you take all the candidates running for attorney general, both as Democrats and Republicans, and you put all of their prosecutorial experience together, it doesn't even come close to the number of cases that I've prosecuted. But I have also defended those cases. So when you want to hire someone, elect someone for the office of attorney general, I think you want the largest breadth of experience as possible. And that comes from me. And I think what's been missing in that office is an understanding of the criminal justice system from both sides. And I'm the only one that can bring that to that type of perspective to this office.
A couple other things I want to touch on real quickly. Do you think Bill Schuette has politicized the Flint water crisis for a personal advantage?
100%. Absolutely, I do.
Okay. And one other thing I want to ask you, if the legislature passes a law that you don't personally agree with, will you defend it if that law is challenged in court?
I will defend it unless the law is flagrantly unconstitutional. And I have seen laws that have been passed over the years that even though the legislature has been warned that that bill has been flagged, that it violates the Constitution, you know, they proceed with it anyway. They don't care. And I think it's a waste of taxpayers' dollars for the Attorney General to be put in a position where you have to defend any law, no matter how unconstitutional, because as AG, you take an oath. You take an oath to uphold the Michigan Constitution and to uphold the United States Constitution. To me, you are violating that oath when you proceed and you defend a flagrantly unconstitutional law.
All right. And then last thing I wanted to ask you, obviously we've only got 6 days until the endorsement convention. How do you feel right now going into it? We've had some endorsements last few days or so that didn't go your way as far as the big union endorsements, UAW, AFL-CIO. How confident are you feeling, though, going into the endorsement?
Well, I always expected that the leadership of those unions would endorse Pat Miles. They recruited him. You know, I was told that in the very beginning. And I knew that, you know, entering the race 8 months ago. But the thing that I've been able to do is I've been able to persuade so many members of those unions and so many other unions. And then I am the only person, if you look at endorsements, since we're talking about that, mm-hmm. I am the only person that brings this wide range of endorsements. So, yes, I have labor endorsements, too. I have, you know, some of the biggest labor unions in the state, including the MEA. But in addition, I have so many other groups. I have women's groups. I have cannabis groups. I have LGBTQ groups. I have groups that represent minority communities. I have all of the progressive groups. So I am the only candidate in this race that can really create unity in the party because I have so much support from so many different areas of the party. I don't come from just one area of the party, and that's the only people that may be supporting me. I have this wide range all across the spectrum. So I'm feeling very good about it. I know that we have people coming all across the state to support me. I'm a little concerned because I hear there may be a snowstorm coming this weekend. And we have people coming from Skokie, you know? So
they may have to take a snowmobile then.
Yeah, they have a lot of them in Skokie. so, you know, I really believe that we're going to see just an absolute flood of people coming to the convention on Sunday. And I'm so excited to see so many Democrats engaged in the process. And I honestly believe at the end of the day, I'm going to be successful on Sunday and that, you know, whoever's on the ticket, we're going to go forward to November and we're going to have a clean sweep and a big, beautiful blue wave in November. And I think the Democrats are finally going to take back this state.
Dana Nessel, Democratic candidate for Attorney General. Appreciate you coming on the podcast here on such short notice.
Thanks for having me, Kyle. I really appreciate it.
All right, joining us now for some pre-endorsement convention analysis, Target Insights, Ed Zarpolis. Ed, thanks for joining us here. Give us some thoughts here on what we can expect.
I'm not endorsing anybody. You implied endorsement. I'm being nonpartisan here as a review of the. You imply endorsements.
Right, exactly. I'm not endorsing anyone. You're not endorsing anyone.
No, I'm evaluating what's going on. I've done a number of conventions in my life, and you're asking me what's going on.
What's happening in this one?
Well, this one here is sort of unique. This is sort of like the changing of the guard. Okay. This is a continuation of 2016. You have the Bernie Sanders group versus the normal Democratic infrastructure, okay? Number two, you have the African-American community versus the non-African-American community, okay? So here's what happened. Here's a couple things going on. It's not just, what we're talking about here is the race for Attorney General. Who is the Democrats going to nominate? Now, remember, the official nomination process isn't until August.
That's right.
This is encouraging who the party regulars, not the party, this is not a party nomination. This is the delegate nomination because there is no party nomination until August. Okay, so this is saying what we would like to encourage the rest of the Democrats to consider going into the convention next November. Why is that? Because of the fact this allows the candidate that gets picked in his pre-nomination to start raising money. Because that's where everybody wants to gather around by. Typically what happens, like with Andy Dillon versus Virge Bonero back in 2010, Dillon still went on and made it very close, but Virge Bonero got all the Democratic family to support him in the primary, and that's why he made it through the primary. So what's happening here is Democrats are saying, look, we're going to have a tough November. So we want to be sure that we can save our money for the November races versus beating each other up going into the convention, because this is a convention vote, not a primary vote like the August primary is for governor. So this is all to basically get everybody together, give them months of advance time to raise money, get organized for the fall convention. But what's happening here, this not pre-nomination convention is more than just the Attorney General's race and the pick for Supreme Court justices, because I think there's only one, particularly as of today's story, I can pick, and it'll be Ms. Megan Kavanaugh. Okay, good resume, everybody agrees with that, would be picked at the pre-nomination, but there's still an open seat. I don't think they've come down to the final.
Oh, it was going to be that Bagenstos guy.
I'm hearing the fact, but I haven't heard yesterday if it's confirmed yet.
Okay.
And it also could say change by, remember, this could also change by November, August also. Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen is we get two candidates. A third one could come in and say, remember, so the bottom line is that the Democrats may find another candidate who has more visibility, willing to run and raise money. So this could still change in August. Both these could. But the bottom line, this is sort of a start for that. Also, as you know, in a Supreme Court race, a Democrat could go and collect signatures and still get on the ballot, even without the party's convention. All they have to do is collect signatures.
That's right. They could run it as an independent.
They could run as an independent. So I'm saying the judicial thing is less certain. I mean, obviously the party would like, and member regulars would like to see that. So what's going on here? We also have the forming of what's going to happen in the governor's race. Mm. This whole conversation, remember last fall when they started talking about this and early this year, this is only going to be about the down ballot tickets. But because Gretchen Whitmer now is either tied or trailing in the polls against Reith Allender, you got the El Sayed, you know, battling to stay on the ballot. There's going to be a whole debate what to do about the governor's race.
Hmm. And even though they won't decide it in any formal way, there's going to be a lot of discussion about it. So what are we expecting? What should we see as far as visibility?
The bottom line is if I were the Gresham people, I would be forcing a vote at the convention to say that she gets the nod. Why is that? Because like they did with Virge Bonero versus Andy Dillon, Gretchen Whitmer doesn't want to have to spend her money that she has raised so far on a primary. She was hoping to save the money for the general election. If she has to take the money now that she's going to be using for the primary, that's money that she's now going to have to figure out how do I replace it for the November election.
So she's looking for some type of informal endorsement, some kind of nod. And so if she can push the envelope at this thing, then that gives her a leg up.
Yeah, it does give her leg. And here's the other reason why she doesn't remember. The whole conversation right now is the party's now deciding who the lieutenant governor is. Mm-hmm. We've got this commission of party poopas, not people, ordinary people, but people who basically who have the say in what happens at the party. So going into this convention was hoped the fact that Gretchen would be the chosen one, the one who would be leading in the polls. So now they've got some groundwork to take care of. What do you do about Reith Allender? If he doesn't step away, he can spend $6 million. So this race is more than just Gretchen saying, I'm it, let's gather around me. Now, in fact, they're going to have to decide, can she actually help me find my lieutenant governor? Because there she's assuming now, though the polls show differently, that she's not the preemptive favorite going into the August primary. So this is a whole different battle. Number three, what else is going to be on the scenes? You now have traditionally the party regulars and the labor groups now basically might be opposing somebody like Dana Nessel. The black community would prefer an African-American running for this seat, which is Pat Miles. Mm-hmm. They're hoping to use Obama to help raise money for Pat Miles and help Obama's endorsement. So you got the black community labor saying, why now if we go with Dana Nessel, we won't be able to take advantage of Obama mm-hmm. to come into the state to raise money and excite the vote going into November. Fourthly, what else do you have here? This is also a test of labor strength.
It is.
Because they still haven't announced how they're going to do the vote. If you read the newspaper, is it going to be one big massive vote if you're a party member and get the vote? Or is it going to be proportional by congressional district?
Where in those kind of cases, then, your vote might not be one vote. It might be 7/10 of a vote.
That is correct.
Or you could be 2/10 of a vote, or you could be 2.5 votes.
That's correct. I've been in these battles before in conventions with bipartisan battles. The fact is that they could decide how the vote's going to take place on Saturday. The executive could say the fact we're going to do proportional based by congressional district or by county.
Because if the first congressional district comes up with 700 people, but the 13th congressional district comes in with
two people,
those two people in the 13th congressional
have more power than in a proportional vote than the people in 7 out of 8. So the bottom line is, Richard Bernstein lost a similar run for AG by missing a vote out of Berry County back when he was running for AG. Remember that? That's a few years back. Okay. So the bottom line is I have yet to hear, are they going to go with the current standard of how the people are going to be picked? Is it just majority vote, whoever there who has the right to vote? Or is it going to be proportional by congressional district or by county?
One more thing I want to bring up here, Ed, is the role of labor. UAW, AFL-CIO have both supported Pat Miles kind of late in the game here. Is there a potential where they could get beaten this convention?
Well, they could be beaten because, in fact, I remember back in 1998 when the Supreme Court justices were up. I was working then for Mary Jean Kelly, who became Supreme Court Justice. The Michigan Education Association and other people decided to support Mary Jane Kelly versus over their nominee. And bottom line is we outworked our people who come to the convention in turnout, so thereby we won. Labor worked very hard. You remember what's going to happen when labor people show up to the convention. There'll be a caucus beforehand, and the laborers will get together by their caucus and saying, this is how we're going to vote as a block. So the bottom line, if Dana Nessel is successful in getting enough people to the polls that outranks the number of people showing up from labor, then she could win. But if the rules are by proportional vote, the labor are going to be sure that they have proportional vote by each thing. And thirdly, labor has many members as part of the executive committee. So this is basically, remember, this happened to Mark Brewer. Remember that whole thing?
Well, yeah. Now, in that case, UAW actually went out and recruited their own candidate.
Correct. But it still came down to a fight, a floor fight. And they still were counting votes. They were orchestrating votes. This is what convention is about. Whether it's Republican convention, Democrat, it's always about orchestrating votes. The question is labor waited to the end because they were hoping this was going to play out. Eric Smith was going to get in because then there was going to be, everybody was going to get behind Eric Smith. There was no choice. And also, there's polling that mirrors did, just showing the fact that Democrats don't want an all-female ticket. They want a balanced ticket. And most labor people will tell you the fact that they have their best chance, the fact that they have a balanced ticket going into November. So this is more about whether labor wants it as a labor choice, is what is good for them to have a victory coming into November. So labor, this will be a big battle for labor to do what they did against Mark Brewer to take over the party back a couple of years ago. And the same thing here, the fact that they still can rally their members. Mm-hmm. And remember, they still have to decide who gets the vote. Are you a paying member? Did you register? Did your ballots count? So all these things will come into play on Sunday.
Okay. Great. Ed Zarpolis from Target Insight. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure. This week.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. I'm Kyle Malin for John Rurink, Jacob Kanzler, and Jack Spencer. Until next week, take care.